You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Good morning and welcome to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Today we are in the second installment of our summer podcast on movie psychos. So welcome. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so last time we dug up some ancient psychos from before 55. And today we're going to be talking about full color psychos post, let's say, 2000, I think. We tried to figure out last time what sort of linked all these psycho movies together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, you guys, if you think movie psycho, who is your like stereotypical movie psychopath? Matt, you go first.
I mean, I do think there's a watershed there. I think the original generic or stereotypical movie psycho, I think, would definitely have been Norman Bates. The film is called Psycho. That's what you think of. But I do think that there was a watershed with Silence of the Lambs, basically. And I think that Hannibal Lecter in that film, I mean, we had seen Hannibal Lecter in a movie before in Manhunter. He was played by Brian Cox, I think. But Anthony Hopkins' version of Hannibal Lecter was, I think, he became a blueprint, I think, for so many movie psychos following Silence of the Lambs. And I think at that point, before that, I think psychos were basically mad. They were pathological. They were traumatized. They were closeted homosexuals. They were individuals with mummy or daddy issues. There was trauma. There was psychopathology. Or I think as with Night of the Hunter, they were evil, immoral. They were basically the bogeyman in human form. But I think from Hannibal Lecter onwards, movie psychos tended to be less immediately insane and more kind of these people who see themselves as the Nietzschean Superman. You know, they are superior to the herd. And therefore, they are above human morality. And I think Hannibal Lecter has that very much. He's kind of the psychopath as artist. His murders are kind of aestheticized works of art. He's the psychopath as director or as celebrity also, I think, to some extent. The psychopath as the dungeon master who creates these complex puzzles for the detectives to kind of solve somehow. And I think we had several of these psychos since. I mean, we had variations, of course, but I think John Doe in Seven has some of that killings as art. You've got Dexter, and he sees himself somehow as morally superior, and that's why he can kill these other psychos. Can I just open a quick footnote here? I was wondering, when we're talking about psychos, I think we're mostly also talking about serial killers. And the serial killers that we have in movies and TV series, they're pretty much all of them psychos the way we talk about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I sort of see a switch in the way we see movie baddies mm-hmm. between the pre-serial killer era and the post-serial killer era, mm-hmm. right? So you have all these horrifying but big true life stories about Dempsey and Bundy and all these horrible people. And I think after that, the movie Psycho became, I think, a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how I see it. And that's why I think in the modern sense, we think of psychos as serial killers, though they weren't, I don't think, as much originally, because I think we got sort of bitten by the bug of these big news stories, right? These big true crime stories. So that's my take.
Mm-hmm. I think the original psychopaths or the original serial killers, they killed because they were in danger to be found out, like Norman Bates or so. And then later, the serial killers killed because they had some kind of need to kill and didn't bother that much anymore in order to be found out, things like that. And of course, then the body count mounted and the screenwriters maybe thought that made them more interesting, and that was not always the case. That's my take on a very short typology of serial killers. I mean, more bodies does not make a more interesting serial killer. You have to do something else. Of course, Hannibal in the series is very, very interesting. Plus, there's a very high body count. That's maybe the exception to the rule.
And there's also very high serial killer count. I mean, basically, probably more of the characters in Hannibal are serial killers than there's characters who aren't serial killers. And everyone, in a way, has a little serial killer inside them. And Hannibal tries to coax that out. He's like the coach of serial killers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... I've looked up on the internet what they say about, you know, the 20 best or most important movie psychos. And I think, you know, yeah, you get very different types. You know, they mention, for instance, Jack Torrance in The Shining, Annie Wilkes in Misery, Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, who is definitely, I think, a psycho.
Oh, yeah.
Psycho. But I think when I think of a movie psycho these days, it is really Hannibal Lecter who comes first and foremost. He's just, he's the... big daddy of psycho killers.
Yeah.
All right. So, do you agree, Maga? Is this your also your sort of stereotypical the psycho you think of when you think of movie psychos?
I think it's hard to pin down a stereotype if you are not referring to any specific time in which the movie or the series in question has been made. I mean, there has been an involvement. I mean, the one of the latest developments is a serial killer killing other serial killers. I mean, some people have stopped watching crime series just because it has become too post or too meta. You know, serial killer in the employ of the police killing other serial killers. It's too much for them. I understand the appeal, but I think there is hardly a stereotypical psycho or serial killer anymore. It depends on which decade or so you want to refer to. I know that's some sort of excuse to not answer the question, but there's a whole spectrum of people with intentions to kill or to maim or to sort of abuse people. You have to see it in the context of the whole development. It's now 50 or 60. No, it's much longer, 70 or 80 years for real psychos and serial killers to appear on screen. So they've come a long way, and you have to see where they come from. I mean, the context is, of course, much different 100 years ago than it is today as well. You agree or do you vehemently disagree?
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, if I would have to take a stereotypical psycho out of the bag, like pick one, I'd go for the same movie as you, Matt, Silence of the Lambs, but mine would be Buffalo Bill.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right, because he's, if you're talking about stereotypes, quite apart from the rather lovely performance, that's what you think of, right? You think of these weird obsessions, hang-ups, mummy issues, gender issues, all sorts of weird pathology. And then also, as you say, however weird that sounds, the art of murder. So... and you know, I've heard this sentence used by actual in real crime books, like actual crime books, where they, you know, where they talk about the art and the artists, though real serial killers apparently are not as smart and brilliant and good looking as the ones in movies. But I'd plump for Buffalo Bill because he's so obviously sick and he's so obviously very dangerous, and he's like the big game of Silence of the Lambs. So so I do agree with you both that pre these true crime media stories, a serial murderer or a psycho would be something different. Think about, for instance, Strangers on a Train, where you could sort of say, okay, this guy is a total psycho, right? But we don't think of them as such because we don't have this sort of horror movie, over-the-top, bloody, ultimate violent splatterfest, because it didn't happen before a certain time in movies, right? We didn't get these weird splatterfests, murder, gore things. So that's what I think is the difference. And that's why I would plump for really a rather more modern stereotype. So the sort of Buffalo Bill, let's make a dress out of actual really weird types. That would be mine. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Strangers on a Train, and I think it's interesting that in some ways, yes, that one is very old-fashioned, but I think it also, it prefigures the more sociopathic murderers that that we sometimes get. You know, the utterly amoral, the... I think he very much fits, in some ways, this notion of the serial killer who sees himself as morally superior. He's better than the other people, so therefore, if he kills them, that's... okay, that's only normal for him. And I think that is something that's actually relatively modern. While at the same time, you also have all the cliches and the, you know, kind of the sublimated homoerotic element there, which is, of course, very, very old-fashioned in that form. But I think there are kind of some modern touches there. It's also, you know, I was thinking of Hitchcock with, what is it, Shadow of a Doubt? The one with Uncle Charlie?
Yep.
Who is basically, if I remember, he basically goes around, you know, wooing women and killing women. And he's very, also very much kind of prefigures this kind of sociopath who, if someone stands in his way, if he wants something from someone and it means killing them, he'll kill them. And I think in that respect, it's quite fitting that you have a quasi remake of that in, what was it called? Stoker? By one of the Korean directors whose names I can never remember.
Mm-hmm.
And Stoker is pretty much a remake of Shadow of a Doubt, except it's again one of those where everyone is a potential psycho, and it's freaky as hell. If you need to be chilled down, if you really need to feel cold in this kind of hot weather, watch Stoker, because it's one of the most chilling films I've seen.
All right.
Okay, so talking about films you have to watch, you brought me some today, films and series with, well, arguably movie psychos in them. So what did you bring, Maga?
I brought The Sopranos, mainly Tony Soprano. It's probably not a spoiler, but maybe a disappointment. I don't consider Tony Soprano much of a psychopath because there is empathy there in what he does. And of course, that needs a lot of elaboration. In Tony Soprano, there are definitely some moral pieces missing. He comes from a gangster archetype. He's the mob boss of New Jersey for much of the series. There is a kind of mafia nostalgia we always have because these are bad guys, but they, by and large, they get away with it. He is a weird mixed bag of what he thinks is moral and immoral, what he thinks is necessary, and what he thinks is absolutely out of the question. I mean, apart from being the mob boss with all the money making and the bullying and the threatening, and of course also the killing and the defending of the territory, or whatever technical terms they would like to use. Morally, he is a constant surprise, and mostly not in a good way. I mean, if you watch the series, you almost forget that he sort of cares for his wife and his daughter and his son. But that doesn't prevent him from getting physically abusive towards Carmela, his wife. I made a little list. You know, he has an overbearing mother. Hello, Norman Bates. He's a racist. He hates blacks. I mean, when his daughter brings home her black boyfriend, he immediately comments on his being black and says that, you know, you're going to say you liked it here, and then you say goodbye, and then you break up with her, and I never want to see you again. He puts it in much, much stronger words, which I can't repeat because I don't want this podcast end up on the series, on the index, sorry. And then on the other hand, you know, for all this racism and physical abuse, even within his own domestic setting, he has weak spots for dogs and horses and animals. And he likes people and animals on instinct. He dislikes them on instinct, and he even kills them because he doesn't like their attitude. So there is some kind of psychopathic behavior, but it's almost like he can choose that kind of attitude. When I realized that, I had to think of that early scene in Hannibal, the series, where Will Graham and Crawford, when they are talking about the guy who killed these girls, Crawford says, "Is he a psychopath who feels empathy? What kind of crazy is he?" And Will Graham doesn't have an answer, because it's the hallmark of a psychopath to not feel empathy. And Tony Soprano isn't like that, but he has moments where he's an absolute psycho. You could take the series and cut these scenes one after another, and you would have a psycho. But it would be wrong, because it would only have elements of psychopathic behavior. He does have empathy, but that does not prevent him from being an absolute violent person. And I haven't even mentioned Dr. Melfi. You know, at one moment he confesses his undying love for her and almost wants to elope to Vegas with her in order to marry her. And then he threatens her in no uncertain terms. So you never know where you're at with that guy. He's not a violent person who comes for you relentlessly. He might change, but the fact that he's so absolutely unaccountable in some ways makes him even more dangerous. You can't rely on him. You never know where you are with him. Yeah, there are psychopathic moments, but a real psychopath, no. I mean, we have mentioned Tony Soprano in the first part, but I don't think, because he's the hallmark of a true blue dyed-in-the-wool stereotypical psychopath. You've seen the series as well. What do you think?
It's so interesting, because I rewatched some of them, not all of it, but some of them, just with the perspective of this podcast. Like, is Tony Soprano a psycho, right? Yeah. And he is, in the sense that he's a total narcissist. I didn't really pick up on that. It didn't really register enough the first and the second time I saw the series, and now I see this from this perspective. What makes him dangerous is that he is a classical narcissist, in the sense that he has, you know, everything is about control with him, and everything is about him with him, and what all the other people are doing to him with him, whether they're toxic or not. And there are enough toxic people in this series for him to have a point in being angry, right? But all of this is about his sort of idea that the world is out to get him, that he is the be-all and end-all of morality, and what is right and what's not, and he's the boss, right? So he registers to me in that sense, is that in my sort of head, this narcissism is something you see a lot with our fictional psychos, this really classical narcissism, where they're the center of the universe and they get really angry and violent if somebody dares to not put them in the center of the universe, or when they lose control over other people. I don't know if you agree with this, but in that sense, I see him as a sort of psycho, or at least a sociopath, you know?
Yeah. I think I would totally agree with that. And I have to say, depending on if I was talking after seeing the series once, I might say something else. If I hadn't seen the ending of The Sopranos, I might also say something else. But I think I would disagree with you, Maggie, to some extent. I'm not sure that Tony feels genuine empathy. For that, I think he is too narcissistic. What he does have is he's got a massive sentimental streak. I think he can go from ordering a hit on someone to, oh, look at those ducks, and oh, so-and-so's mother died. He is a sentimentalist, and I think that is not... I think in some episodes, at some points, I would have said, oh, you know, there's hope for him because he does feel empathy. By the end of the series, I'm not sure that's really there, because I think, as you said, Julie, I think even when he displays what seems to be empathy, it still is about him, how it makes him feel, what it makes him want to do or not do. So in that respect, I would say he is probably more of a psycho in the movie sense than he would seem at first. And I think that's also why his psychologist, Dr. Melfi, at some point says, sorry, no, I'm stepping away from this because I cannot do anything for you. I think in that respect, though, he's not a psycho as in he's a unique psychotic with a unique kind of pathology. I think he's a psycho that's very, very common, especially these days. And I think we're probably later going to talk about another psycho who's actually, he looks very different at first, but I'm not sure he is all that different, because I do think that The Sopranos, one aspect of The Sopranos is it's a satire of American ultra-capitalism, which is what the mafia to some extent is. It's predatory capitalism taken to an extreme. It's unbound by law or morality. And I think Tony is very much an example of that. He's a sociopath where everything is about what do I want, how do I get it, and who do I have to do over in order to get it. So I do think he's a certain kind of modern, very American psycho in that respect, but he's a psycho that you'll find a lot in big business or in politics or, dare I say it, in the White House. I'm pretty sure that Tony Soprano these days, if he survived the ending of the series, would be walking around with a Make America Great Again hat.
Yeah.
All right. I think we could fill like 5 podcasts by talking just about The Sopranos because it's so interesting and fascinating. And it's one of the great television series. For anybody out there listening to us who hasn't yet gotten to it, see it, do yourself a favor. It's really fantastic. But I wanted to get to our second psycho. So, Matthew, what movie did you bring us?
I brought us one of the David Fincher psychos, but it's not John Doe from Seven, who I quickly mentioned last time around. It's actually Zodiac, the film, and the Zodiac Killer. I think it's a fascinating example because, on the one hand, it totally plays into some of the stereotypes. You've got the psychopath as serial killer. You've got the psychopath as the puzzle master, you know, figure out my puzzles and you might find me. It's also the psychopath as a media celebrity. I think it's really at the beginning where basically on the radio, on television, in newspapers, everyone's talking about this psycho killer. The interesting thing, I think, is that the myth of the Zodiac is bigger than the Zodiac himself. How many people does he actually kill that we know of? I think 4 or 5. That's pretty horrible, yes. But in terms of movie psychos, he's actually not killed all that many people. But in people's heads, his myth explodes. And also, I think he's the psycho as puzzle in the sense that the obsession that the film is about is not so much the serial killer's obsession, but it's the obsession of the people who think they can solve this puzzle. And if they can solve the puzzle, they can solve the crimes, they can find the murderer. But for a film about a psycho, about a serial killer, we never actually see and recognize the Zodiac killer. We see several Zodiac killers. I mean, several, I say that several because I think Fincher actually had different actors with different heights, different builds playing the Zodiac when he murders. We never see his face. We just see his, I think he's got this hood that he wears. He's just wearing kind of a black sweater, black trousers. We see several suspects, even likely suspects, but we never know, was it that person? For every clue that says it was this guy, it was that guy, we get another one or two clues that say, actually, no, the evidence doesn't bear it out. So in Zodiac, even though it's about a serial killer, a real existing serial killer, the actual psychopath is a complete absence. And that is, I think, what drives some of the characters almost insane. Their obsession to fill this blank with meaning, to somehow explain it away, is forever going to be frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to find out, okay, he did this because his mother was nasty to him. He did this because he represses his homosexuality. No, none of those simple, simplistic pop psychological answers. He's not going to be explained. He's probably just a guy who likes the attention. And we don't even know who he is, whether he's still around. Is he dead? Is he alive? Was he this guy? Was he that guy? We don't know. And that I find fascinating, that in a way, Zodiac is less about the serial killer than about our obsession as the audience with serial killers, with psychos.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing, perhaps quickly, one thing that I find very fascinating, as I said, I think there's lots of psycho killers after Hannibal Lecter who basically have killing as art. You present your victims in a way that's kind of aestheticized. And I think the murders that we do see in Zodiac are exactly the opposite of that. They're horrific, yes, but at the same time, they're also kind of banal. It's basically, if you stab someone, that's just horrible, but it's not somehow gratifying in a way that it is in slasher movies to some extent, in a way that it is in Hannibal to some extent. The murders are awful and horrible, and they're more horrible because they are kind of so everyday and not aestheticized. So I think in a way it's an anti-psycho film. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, and it acquired some currency with the Golden State Killer, which was very widely publicized. I think they just found out who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And rewatching this movie, The Zodiac, really sort of linked into that for me, because there was a book, there were amateur detectives on the mm-hmm. internet, people who couldn't let this case go. And a very underrated movie, but that is sort of how current it is. That linked me to exactly what we're having right this year with the Golden State Killer and all the books that came about that subject. Of course, the Zodiac was an actual criminal.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of the sort of weird link that I made, is how current this film still is, right? Mm-hmm. It was made in, I think it's 2007.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's more than 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And we still, as an audience and as watchers, have this obsession with these weirdos, right?
Yeah.
These weirdo murderers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you agree with me.
Totally. I mean,
no, I agree.
I'm thinking of, you know, basically almost any kind of TV series these days that's built around a murder case and who is it of these 20 people in the community. People obsess over that. You've got Reddit threads about who was it and was that a hint? Was this a hint? Mag and me, we often kind of make jokes about, you know, these murder walls that detectives have in movies where you've got little pieces of paper with the names of suspects and bits of evidence and bits of string, blue string, red string, yellow string, somehow supposedly bringing structure to this chaos, but actually it just amplifies the chaos. And I think movie audiences, and especially TV audience, we have these murder walls, sometimes literal ones. We all become these hobby detectives, totally. So I think it's a very good point you're making.
Mm-hmm. I think movies like Zodiac are also a comment on storytelling, either accidental or intentional. In Fincher's case, I would say he's so smart that it's probably intentional. What I mean by a comment on storytelling is we don't know who done it. And that makes the story much, much, much more interesting. I mean, the people who still write books about Jack the Ripper, you know, there must be 20 meters of books for Jack the Ripper only. And we have to face the fact that we are never going to know who did it. So there are going to be more books and more books and more books, which, of course, makes the story much sexier.
Mm-hmm.
I read Michelle McNamara's book on the Golden State Killer when it was not clear who done it. And it was one of those books where I thought I have to lock the front door, and I really don't scare easily. It feels like I've said this on that podcast before, but I can't really remember. And then it came out who did it, and I was really glad that I read the book before that news came out. And she was right. She predicted that there would be a hint from, what do you call those homepages? Those ancestry mm-hmm. homepages, you know, where you could trace back your ancestry.
Yeah. And send in your DNA, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And their DNA database is bigger than the FBI's or any kind of police institutions. And that's where the hint came from. And they solved. Mm-hmm. Well, it took a while longer, but the story is now, it's now done, you know. So any story that's unsolved is much more interesting because, you know, it could have been your neighbor, theoretically. Maybe he was, you know. Where was he two nights ago? We don't know. So it's a kind of McCarthyism, if we want to go with US politics a little bit more. You have that Freudian suspicion about anybody or everybody. You don't know what's going on. You don't know other people because, in a way, you think that something might be going on. Your neighbor might be a communist, or it might be a psychopath, a serial killer. And because we don't know, I mean, to give the story the full circle, because we don't know who the Zodiac is or was, it's a much more open story. It's an open-ended story. We don't know the ending. And so we still ponder, was it the same guy? Was it another guy? Did he only kill 3? Did he kill up to 50? You know, because he was, obviously he was mobile. he was physically able, and so on and so on. That's the stories we think about. The stories that end with whodunit. If they're not really, really good, we forget them. They must be on a level with Agatha Christie or some or Sherlock Holmes in order to be remembered. Others we forget. If you're mediocre with a whodunit, you're forgettable. And the open stories, they're still there. That's what I mean with a comment on storytelling.
It's such a compliment to the movie as well, because it's a difficult story, I think, to tell. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very underrated movie. I think people expect gore. There's the little ballet of blood at the very beginning, which is sort of very stylized with the shootings. But that's it. That's all we get. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's any sort of wish there that you see some sort of, you know, gore, it's not there. If you, exactly as Maga says, if you think this is a whodunit, wrong again. Mm-hmm. We don't find out who did exactly. It. So it's an incredible feat of filmmaking as well. It's a very nifty trick to pull off in a 2.5-hour movie where we don't get to have Hannibal Lecter chewing scenery. We don't get to have lots of blood and gore and Freddy's going to get you. We just watch these people disintegrate over this obsession, mm-hmm. and this anxiety and this ever-present fear of this human amongst us who behind the mask, maybe your neighbor, maybe mm-hmm. anyone. Yeah, absolutely. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think the movie possibly suffered a bit from audience expectations exactly because it was David Fincher doing it. Because David Fincher, he made his name especially with Seven, which is also, I think it's a more typical serial killer movie, but I also think it does interesting things with the serial killer. But people, I think, were expecting Seven Part 2. Mm-hmm. It isn't, of course. It's true crime, and it is about basically whodunit frustrated. And I agree with you, Maga, that keeps the story interesting, but I think people still expect that it ends with a reveal. People still, they're okay with a sequel, you know, okay, the Zodiac Killer is dead, but here's Son of Zodiac, that kind of thing. and we don't get that. We basically, I think it's fascinating that in a way the film almost ends with a bit of a screw you. It ends with the first surviving victim of the Zodiac pretty much identifying one of the suspects. He says, I'm 80% sure that's him. Of course, 80% doesn't get you even a cup of coffee. And of course, the next we see is a text card saying that the actual evidence speaks against that identification. So it's like, it was him, or was it? And it's you're left with this frustration. I think in that respect, I actually find Zodiac, the film, very similar to... Have you both read From Hell by Alan Moore?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Jack the Ripper. It's amazing that we took such a long time to get to Jack the Ripper. You mentioned that before, but I think it's less From Hell, the actual graphic novel, than the second appendix that Alan Moore has in there, which is basically yet another comic, which is about the whole story about Ripperology, all those people writing books, trying to find out who the Ripper was, mm-hmm. how it still sells, how we're still obsessed with it, and how none of these books get us any closer to either finding out who the Ripper was or talking about the most important thing, you know? It's like we're all focused on the Ripper, this guy who committed these horrific murders. No one's talking about the prostitutes who were being killed other than here's another artwork by the Ripper. And I think serial killer movies, especially bad serial killer movies, have that. It's not about the victims. It's about this almost anti-hero. We want the serial killer to be caught mostly, but with Hannibal Lecter, we also like him. We like watching him. So part of us wants it to go on. And I think, again, that's one respect in which Zodiac does the opposite. We don't want the Zodiac to go on because what he does is just so horrible, but not horrible in a way that you kind of enjoy it surreptitiously.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I brought you a film also. It's one of my pets. So be kind, right? It's one of my favorite. I would call it a horror movie ever, which speaks to my dark sense of humor. It's American Psycho. And this is, it's called American Psycho. This is definitely a psycho in the narcissistic mold. So it's Christian Bale playing a man named Patrick Bateman who does something undefined in finance, apparently has a lot of money, and says right at the beginning, there is no such thing as me, right? I'm a mask and I'm an empty shell, which is absolutely true. why I love this movie so much, irrationally, irrationally much, is that I hated the book. And then the script was passed on and on and on. I think Oliver Stone was attached at some point. And then a woman made it. And this is, I don't often go on my soapbox in these cases, but in this case, it's significant because the woman who made it sees through the narcissism, the cheapness, the crybaby assholery of these everyday narcissists that we almost run into them. He's not just a creep. He's a shallow creep. And the movie doesn't make any excuses for him. The movie shows us his suffering in a sense, but he doesn't sympathize with him. It just says, look at you, you pathetic beast, you know, you stupid animal. If it had gotten into the wrong hands, it would have been a slasher, a stupid slasher with, again, no love for the victims. And the power in this movie is that it really, really takes care of its victims. It looks at the victims, even if it's a hooker, a street prostitute, a ditzy, weird college type, anyone, no matter how, you know, imperfect, the movie looks at them straight on and says, this is a human being. And this human being is about to get slaughtered by this madman, right? So I was wondering, did you get a chance to see it? And what did you think?
I've seen it many, many years ago. I remember liking it very much. I read the book shortly after it came out. I very much hated it. I think I finished it out of pure spite because I don't like to be vanquished by a bad text. I only know bits and pieces from the movie. I should have rewatched it and I didn't have the chance. I'm terribly sorry. I remember the book being all either complete surface or abject, cold-blooded, neurotic violence without any kind of remorse or even there's no pulse. There's nothing redeeming. It's just more and more and more of violence. And the violence only stops when there's a review of Huey Lewis' latest CD. You know, it's horrible. It's just, I couldn't stand the book at all, but I finished it. Sorry, I have nothing to say about it.
Matt, did you get a chance to see it again?
Yeah, well, I watched it for the first time about a week ago. I avoided the film for a long, long, long time because I was traumatized by the book, and not even the whole book. Back then when it came out, I'd go to bookshops and I kind of leaf around in texts that sounded interesting, and there'd been so much about American Psycho. And I read about two or three pages and they made me feel physically sick. I'm not going to say that that makes it a bad book because I lacked the context of what comes before, what comes after. But I definitely knew that no. I don't want to have that in my head. And for the same reason, I avoided the film for a long time. And when I finally watched it, I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. I think it's a fun film. It's a smart film. It's a great satire. It's very well acted. I agree with you that basically it is very clear about what it thinks about Patrick Bateman, how he is a narcissistic shell of a human being. And I think especially with the prostitute victims, it very much, I think, also says something about, you know, these are not just victims, they're not just objects, but I think they are basically people who always, always, always end up being ground under by the system that Patrick Bateman represents, where, you know, the rich at the top can do whatever they want and the ones at the bottom have to do what they can to survive. And sometimes what happens is they end up getting killed, literally or metaphorically. I think it's a very timely film. When was the film made? It was in the 90s, right? Or just around 2000?
2000, exactly 2000.
And it totally seems to speak to today in terms of politics, society, culture. I think, you know, so many of the kind of internet trolls, so many of the alt-right, so many of the neocons seem to be little kind of Patrick Batemans. In that respect, I think he's also very similar to another not, well, is he a psycho or isn't he? What's his name? Jordan Belmont, right? In Wolf of Wall Street, is such a similar character. We don't see him murdering anyone, but other than that, same thing. You know, these kind of little petty, silly, sad, wannabe masters of the universe. And how do you show your mastery of the universe better than by taking lives, so to speak?
Yeah, I think in the movie, if you remember, there is some uncertainty about whether these murders actually take place, or at least actually take place in the way that Patrick Bateman portrays them in the film. In this sense, the movie forces us into his mind, into his very sick mind. And it's one of the clever tricks it pulls, is that it doesn't really, the violence portrayed on screen, as you said, it's a fun film. It's a horror film, right? It doesn't register, especially later in the movie, as the kind of violence in Zodiac. It registers as almost graphic novel-y, cartoonish. And I think that works very well because it speaks to, we're being sucked in this man's brain and it's not a happy place. It's not a happy place. Also, very literally about Timely, I spotted rewatching it for, I don't know, the umpteenth time, that in the beginning of the film, he actually notes, is that Donald Trump's car?
Yeah.
And then later he sees it, or he lies and he says he sees Ivanka Trump in some sort of shabby restaurant. So it's timely also in that sense, is that now, of course, the gentleman is president, which he wasn't. It's timely in that it was made before the 2008 crash and Enron, which again, it sort of gets an impulse from that. I agree with you, Matt, that it's interesting because it's sort of revived by all these disasters. And the shallowness of the social media age, right?
Exactly.
Right. So, and I'm glad you liked the movie because I hated the book too.
I have a question for you, Julie, but also perhaps for you, Maggie. I mean, you mentioned that there's a point where it's not even clear. Does all of this happen? Does it happen in the way that we've seen it? I think there's some things that are clearly just in Patrick's head. Do you think that thematically it matters all that much whether the murders are real in the film? Do you think it changes the character all that much?
I think there's a key scene that speaks to that at the end of the movie, where Chloe Sevigny's character Jane finds Patrick Bateman's diary and leaps through this and sees, we have no reason to doubt her perspective, right? We are not in Bateman's head right now. She's alone in this office and she sees these horrible cartoons of mutilated women that he's been doodling.
Yeah.
And I think that scene sort of, for me, for my feeling, right, answers your question in terms of that, no, it doesn't matter because this is a violent, psychopathic, narcissistic being. And he could easily, even if the murders did not happen, he could have done them or in a sense ruined people or murdered them in other ways or crushed them in other ways. Whether it exactly happens in the bloody sort of way that we see it in the movie. It doesn't mean that he didn't crush people in his greed with his complete egotism. And we see him do it. We see him do it to Jane. We see him do it in his stupid coke-fueled parties. We see him crushing people all over, regardless of whether he actually called the serving lady a stupid bitch or not. Pardon my French, right?
Exactly.
So I think that scene, for my in my sort of sense of the film, almost answers your question.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's basically about the power fantasy, and he enacts that power fantasy, whether it's in his job or in his private life.
All right, I think that's about time for us. I want to thank our listeners for bearing with us and listening to our summer two-parter about Psychos. This was A Damn Fine Cup of Culture, and I hope you will join us next time. Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.